Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Here's part two of our lovely chat with Mohsin Saidi. If you haven't heard part one, with many funny things, including our chat with Mohsin, but also many other lovely emails and voice notes, head back to the feed, go and listen to part one. Now then, here's part two. Alok Menon talks about this a lot, who's been on this podcast, about there can be an image of Islam as being homophobic, mm-hmm. but actually a lot of, or all of that is actually colonial stuff that was put in.
Because I'm not a historian, I try not to go too far into the kind of, you know, where does it come from? Who's responsible for it? What does that mean for what it looks like today?
Oh, thank God, because I'll be way out of my depth.
Oh, yeah. Also probably bored.
I'm joking.
Bored to hell. But I recognise things as they stand, which is that there are, just like in pockets of society, in pockets of the Muslim community, there is homophobia. But I think that the problem is that we exist in a world where nuance is missing. So I think that Muslims are vilified, and I do think it's easy to equate faith with certain prejudice. And the situation is just, in my experience, is way more complex than that. A lot of the people reaching out to me are heterosexual Muslims who are reaching out to say that they loved the book and that they really support what I'm saying.
Well, because you've sort of become a figurehead for a few things as a result of the book. And one of them was that, you know, you were the first person from your school to go to Oxford. And a lot of people have got in touch with you saying that's really resonated with them.
Yeah, and that's why I said earlier that the book, that's why we changed the subtitle, because for me it's not just about sexuality and faith. It is a book about class and race and just identity in Britain. I should say that the fact that I am the first person from my school to go to Oxford is not something that fills me with pride. It's something that probably once did. And now, as I reflect upon it as an adult and I look at our society, it's shameful. Like, why is it that you get 100 people from one school in 1 year who go to Oxford and Cambridge, and then from my school in the 20 years after which it was formed, there was not one person? So the fact that I'm the first is something that we should all be ashamed of, and it speaks to a much bigger issue when it comes to opportunities, particularly in Britain. You know, I think we often think about America as this really capitalistic society, and we look at America and we say, well, at least we're not like that. At least we have more balance. We're not as aggressively capitalistic as America. But actually, what is more capitalistic than paying for your children to go to the front of every line by giving them a private education? And America doesn't have private schools the way we do. They don't have a kind of a hierarchical education system the way that we do. So for me, class is this thing that I just feel is ignored, or it's definitely not addressed in the way that it should be, particularly in Britain. And I don't think that you can treat it in isolation either. I think that too often we're having conversations about race without thinking about class. Frankly, I don't think that you can do that, particularly in Britain. When you look at the statistics of young people in prisons, over 50% or approximately 50% of all of the children in prison in this country are black or brown or ethnic minorities. So yeah, for me, class is missing.
Because your parents really wanted you to go to Oxford, right? They said, like, you can go, you're not leaving London
yeah.
for university unless it's to Oxford.
Yeah.
Which I just think is hysterical. And so you go to Oxford and it's your parents are really proud and they're telling everybody about it and you're feeling like you're doing the right thing and, you know, that's all great. But through that process of being at Oxford, you, of course, as a person are changing, you know, and then that thing comes where they sort of are kind of saying to you, well, you're getting a bit big for your boots type thing. And there was this moment in the book, which I loved, where there was that fraudulent thing at the post office and you were trying to help your dad, but actually he was kind of acting like you're being condescending to him. And it was sort of, it was like this meeting of all these things you're talking about class and expectation and generational kind of banging in the all together.
Do you know, I, if you don't mind my saying, I'm really touched that you picked up on that because, you know, you talk about, I talk about the book quite a lot and often you're talking about the same issues, but to have somebody pick up on that particular experience, and I'll tell you what it is now, but it really, it's quite moving because there was so much in that tiny sentence. And basically what happened was my dad was wrongfully arrested. He used to run a post office and there was fraud going on and they thought that it was him. There was a drone raid on our house. I had to go back from university and I got home and he was still at the police station. And then a few hours later, he comes home and I said to him, like, you know, tell me everything. So he's explaining that he was interviewed and they asked him whether he wanted a lawyer. And he said, no, I don't need a lawyer. I've not done anything wrong. And I was so frustrated because I was like, Dad, like, how could you have answered their questions without a lawyer present? And his response was to say, don't speak to me like that. Just because you went to Oxford, just because you go to Oxford does not make you better than me, is essentially what he said. And you're right. That was a really difficult experience. And there's so much complication, so many layers of complexity in it.
Mm. And he was saying that, you know, this happening, us being accused of being fraudulent, just confirms what people think of Pakistani people, and we can't let that happen. And almost for him to not choose to take the lawyer was to prove that he was so innocent, right?
Yeah, and absolutely. And and the thing is that mentality of having to do everything that he can to demonstrate his integrity was built on 20 years of racism in this country, right? Like, it was built on having come to this country, being force-fed this hatred about who he is and about what he and his skin colour stand for. And then being involved in a situation where, in his mind, all of those people are standing at the sideline saying, well, see, I told you so, look at him.
Mm. And that in turn is driving a wedge between him and his son.
Yeah, and it's interesting actually, because I remember growing up, my dad used to say, you'll never be one of them, you'll never be white. And he said it specifically to me because he used to think that I was, how to put it? He used to say that I was trying to be white because I was interested in culture and I was sometimes questioning of faith and my interests weren't the same as some of his. And so, yeah, and all of that, his seeing his son turn into this man that he didn't want his son to be, and particularly the queer bit, actually. All of that was based on this experience of being told by the British establishment or by British society that you are not one of us. And then seeing a son raised to become one of them. And it's interesting because I said to him, like, you know, we had a conversation about this, and I was like, well, what did you expect to happen? You sent me to a British university. You sent me to, like, one of the best British universities. Did you not think I would, like, what did you want for me to get from that experience? And he said, I wanted you to take as much as you could, but I didn't want you to give anything. And what you did was you gave everything.
Yourself.
Of myself. And in giving everything, you became one of them.
Wow. I mean, that's wild. Mm-hmm. When also you're like, I'm just trying to tick boxes over here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm just trying to do what you asked me to. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
I'm really there because of you.
Exactly. But it's, you know, it's bizarre. Like, you send a child into this environment because you want them to be able to take advantage of the benefits that can bring, but you don't want them. It's almost like you want the advantages to be selective. You want them to get the education in law, but not in life. You want them to build connections, but not meaningful friendships. I mean, obviously it's way more complex than that, but that's how it felt to me. Was you're sending me into this space for three, four years, but you want me to stay away from all of the things that are available for me to take advantage of there. And that's what, and that was the problem with then coming out, was it was almost like their greatest fear, not the gay bit, but the white bit, the Western bit, the kind of leaving Pakistani community in search of something quote unquote better. All of that was also realized in the moment that I came out to them.
The other thing that's going through my mind as you're saying all of that is that, you know, you come out, I'm thinking fireworks, let's go hang out with my gay family. Well, that's not the full picture, because one of the things that you very openly say in the book is that you remember when you started dating the amount of racism that you experienced.
Yeah.
That made you say to yourself, I wish I could pass for Caucasian as my mum does sometimes.
Yeah. So my mum is really fair skinned and my dad's really dark skinned, which results in me being kind of somewhere in the middle. Very occasionally I get mistaken for being a different ethnicity. And when I was younger and it would happen, I loved it because it felt like I was able to put down baggage. It felt like I was able to put down expectation of the sort of person that I would be, the way that I would smell, the way that the things that would be important to me and to my family. I think that when you are raised in a society where you're the minority and you're from a minority that is constantly vilified, it's no surprise that as a young person, you try and step away from that vilification. And for me, it mattered most when I was trying to find a partner, because, you know, the gay scene is relentless at the best of times. And sometimes, yeah, I hated being brown, because I just thought there is so much that is cut off that just guys just won't look at me because of this.
But people used to say crazy things to you, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So like some of it was horrible. So some of it was like, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't date brown guys, or, you know, they would say, I'm sorry, I'm not into packies and stuff like that. But then the thing is, it would also range from that all the way through to other stuff, which on its face was a compliment. So I had more than one occasion, I had somebody say something like, oh, you're too good looking to be Pakistani. And I remember saying to them, oh, have you been to Pakistan? And obviously the answer is always no. And I was like, oh, really? Oh, so what makes you say that? And then you would explore this person's obviously like squirming. And I said, because what you've just done is said that basically everybody I'm related to and the country I come from is full of really ugly people, and I happen to be an exception. And the thing is, I would respond in that way, actually very politely, because it was in my nature to try and handle these things slightly pointedly, but slightly delicately. And you'd get a person who, you'd get anger. Like, I'm just trying to pay you a compliment. Like, why are you getting so upset? I mean, to be honest, like, I kind of, now I find it quite funny. I mean, it's not funny, but when it happens, it doesn't make me angry anymore. So now I genuinely explore it. Because actually, in exploring it, you can get the person to understand what they really mean, which is, my idea of a South Asian person doesn't fit with you or who you are. And then you can explore the fact that this idea that you have is based on the fact that you think that we all work in curry houses or corner shops, and you've never been exposed to the fact that we are, you know, 1.5 billion people on the planet. And the idea that you wouldn't be attracted to any of us, and the fact that you found one as a surprise is probably statistically, even if nothing else, statistically, it just doesn't make sense.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
But why, we're not going to find the answer here, but why when you very politely, taking up a load of weight that you shouldn't have to take, by the way, is why when you bring it up is the reaction anger? That's what I'm always interested by. Like, because people try and raise stuff with me about things. I go in very, you know, peaceful teacher vibe, but they're just getting angry. And it's like, what, where in your fabric of being, what's being disrupted here that makes you angry?
Well, I think what's being disrupted is the worldview that you don't have to be challenged on anything, you know. And I think the thing is, generally speaking, when we exist in a world that gives privileges to some of us, that world is frictionless. So The sort of men I'm talking to, middle class white men, albeit gay, live in a world of not very much challenge. It's frictionless, and so then suddenly you're presenting this complexity to them. Like, oh, you've said something or you've behaved in a way that's not cool. And that's friction. I mean, I don't know, but I would hazard a guess that the reason that they react with anger is because they're not used to being challenged. They're not used to having to be told, you might be wrong about this.
Mm. It's like power as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's definitely right. Because it is a power, right? Privilege is power. Is being able to walk in the world without having to worry about any obstacles or barriers. That's power. But I should emphasize that I don't think it's malicious most of the time. I remember I went to this party once and it was full of gays. And it was 50th anniversary of like this gay couple, the really rich gay couple that live in London. And I don't know how I managed to get an invite, but I got an invite to this thing. And so I was wearing like this black tie that I'd worn at uni 5 years ago and just had to squeeze into. And I was talking to this couple, and there was an Indian woman. So this room, right, is in some posh place in London, full of people in black tie, predominantly white. In fact, most people were white. It was like 100 people in the room. And about maybe like 6 meters away from me, like nowhere near me, was this woman in a sari. And this guy, this couple in this guy, I was talking to them. They were like asking me how I knew the people whose party it was. And I was like, I actually don't. I don't, you know, I just... And then one of them said, oh, is that your wife? About the woman in the sari. And I looked at the woman, and because I hadn't really realised who they were talking about. And I looked at them, and I just went, I laughed. And I was like, wait, what do you mean, is that my wife? This is a room full of gay men. Why is that your first question? Like, I'm gay. And they were like, oh. And I was like, you literally... And the thing is, I was finding it so funny. So I was calling them out on it, but in like a funny way. I was like, you literally just saw a brown woman in a sari and saw me and thought we must be together. Like, you would rather go to that than the fact that statistically, in a room of like 150 men, I would be gay. Like, what? And I thought it was funny, but they did not. And one of them actually walked off, complained to the guys whose party it was.
Really?
And actually, it turned out that the guys whose party it was were totally like cool and they understood where I was coming from and that I genuinely thought it was funny. But I remember going back and telling my friends about it afterwards and they're like, Mossin, that wasn't funny. That was terrible. I don't know. I mean, he wasn't being malicious. He was ignorant. And I'm sure he won't make that mistake again. So I think that the reason to say that is because fundamentally, yeah, okay, some of these things happen, but they're not... Like, when I think about race, the things that matter to me the most are life, liberty, and economic opportunity. So In this country, your life expectancy is lower. If you're from an ethnic minority background and you're poor, you're disproportionately more likely to go to prison. You're disproportionately more likely to be poor. And those are the things that matter to me. So when people talk to me about microaggressions, and even somebody in a bar, like, telling me that they're not into me because I'm brown, Now, from this vantage point, I'm able to say that those things matter to me less than whether or not that person cares about the fact that most of the kids in prison are ethnic minorities. Now, I'm not saying that doesn't matter, but it just matters less to me.
Yeah, and also, people don't think that happens. That's also the other thing. I think people don't understand those microaggressions happen all day, every day to people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think it's important, like you say, to have some perspective. You know, I'm lucky that I don't get many of them, but when I do get the ones that white gay men get, I'm like, this is boring.
I find microaggressions a bit of an odd term, though, because it's like, well, if it was really aggressive, it's not micro. And it's not really aggressive because most of the time it's not intentional. An aggression, I think, requires some intent. So I find it as an odd term.
I'm always trying to work out why the world is the way it is, you know, which is a fool's errand, but there we go.
Yeah.
And I think...
Well, if you figure it out, let me know.
I'll put it on Instagram. I think what it is that people who don't think the world is any different than what's in front of them on a daily basis, mm-hmm. that is what gets up my nose. And unfortunately, it can make me a little impatient because I feel like I can see it coming a mile off. Which makes me part of the problem. But I think it's that. It's like, that's what a microaggression is someone just assuming they know how the world works because it's based on what is in front of them on a daily basis. Whereas actually it should be like, we should remain open-minded, seeking to be informed and enlightened at every corner, surely?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm not going to disagree with that. I just think that
you're like, no.
No, you know what it is?
No, but just, I think that's what I suppose I'm trying to define a microaggression.
Yeah. I guess the thing is, because as I say, class is really important to me, when I think about how much poverty there is in this country, when I think about the fact that we are one of the richest countries in the world and yet we still have lots of people, lots of children who live below the poverty line and who are having to queue up at food banks with their parents, I do kind of worry that some of the priorities that we should as a society and as a community of people be thinking about are lost. So it's not that those things don't matter to me, it's that those things don't matter to me as much. And once we've sorted out the fact that, you know, we have food banks here, like once those have gone and the societal structural problems that do reinforce and are caused by things like racism and homophobia and sexism, once those are sorted, then I'll have more time for things like microaggressions.
Yeah, but I do think, listen, you're being the bigger person, it's great. But I do think they are from similar places. I think it's about compassion. I think that people don't care about people in food banks because they sort of can't believe it's happening. People don't think it's up. You know what I mean? That's what I think is...
No, I think that's probably right.
There's this lack of compassion beyond your own nose that I think is... been around forever. I don't think that's new. You know, listen to me on my high horse. Tell me about you now, because you're doing many things now.
Well, what am I doing now? So my full-time job is I'm a management consultant at a firm called Hacklett.
Yeah.
So I stopped being a barrister a little while ago. But then I do the stuff that comes up with the book, like this. And so I do some of that, and that's really lovely. And I'm still writing, although... The eternal problem is finding time when you're not a full-time writer. And yeah, I'm on the board of Stonewall. I'm governor at my old school. I think there's a few things that I do. I guess one of the things that's keeping me really busy is that there's a few production companies that are interested in turning A Dutiful Boy into a TV show. And that's amazing. And it's really odd to be sat in a room where people are talking about the character and the character's narrative arc. And you're like, oh, yes. That's me. That's really weird.
Yes.
But that's keeping me quite busy as well, because I'm trying to make sure that it's done in a way that is respectful of the book, but also of my family and of my community.
Because you were a criminal barrister.
Yes.
But then you become a management consultant. Will you just define what a management consultant is for people listening? Because I didn't really know what one was.
Yeah. So a management consultant, well, it really depends. But in my case, it's helping ordinarily the CEOs of companies or the chairman of company boards with really important business decisions. So kind of problem solving and identifying opportunities for businesses. So that's in basic terms what a management consultant does.
So you're like Richard Gere in Pretty Woman.
Yeah, just Dyson Gray. Oh my God, if only. He's gorgeous.
Never done it for me, but anyway, sorry, that's a sidebar. Yeah, don't get it. Richard, if you're listening, I apologize.
Richard, if you're listening, text me.
There's that famous saying of, like, you should notice how you feel after you have spent time with somebody, and then that means they're good for you or bad for you. After being with Mohsin, I just felt invigorated and alive. And I know Fern Cotton talks about this quite a lot on her podcast, because she talks to amazing people who kind of just inspire you, you know? That's how I feel after that chat, and I hope you feel the same. Oh, I'm looking at a Google Doc and it's starting to move. That means someone else is in my Google Doc. Katie's doing it. Katie, she's adding things. Stay in touch over this here festive period. Hello at homosapienspodcast.com. Send us your agony uncle questions. Send us your comments. Contribute to that thing about godparents. Get in touch on Instagram at Homo Sapiens, Facebook at Homo Sapiens Podcast. Next week, to bring in the new year, we'll be chatting to Tori Peters. Tori is an incredible writer who wrote the, I'm going to call it Fleabag-esque, international bestseller, Detransition Baby. Basically, it's the story of the lives of three women, transgender and cisgender, collide after an unexpected pregnancy forces them to confront their deepest desires in one of the most celebrated novels of the year. It is everywhere, all over America, is the book to read. And it's just the way she writes is, it's just amazing and really quick and easy. Not that it has to be, but it is. We had such an amazing chat. Proper chemistry, I would say, between us. I just adored her. And we'd never spoken before or anything. And it was just, you know, when you hit it off with someone? So that's next week. You're going to love it. And if you don't, write in and tell me and we'll talk about it, because that's how it works here. Listeners, I just want to take the opportunity to say thank you for what has been a very strange year, but what has been an incredible year. Having you all here has just been beautiful. And thank you so much for all of your letters, all of your emails, all of your messages. We are one big family, and I feel like it's a big family that grows and grows and grows as the years continue. And I'm so pleased that there is always room at the table, even a bit of grub, for every single one of you. So thank you and have a happy new year. What's your plan for New Year's? Oh my God, and I have to plug my own TV show. New Year's Day, The Tourist on BBC One, starring Jamie Dornan, Shalom Broom Franklin, Danielle McDonald. It's set in the Australian outback, directed by moi, written by my best mates, Harry and Jack. And it is about a guy who wakes up in the middle of nowhere with no idea who he is or where he's come from, and it's kind of a bit like a cross between that film Memento and Fargo. Is that too much of a spoiler? Well, I'll let you be the judge. Loads of love, listeners. See you next week. Bye now.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Powered by Spirit Studios.